Hey, Deserver listeners, let's get into emails and questions from y'all for me and Berto. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Berto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I'm a walking humidifier.
So Orla on Discord asked, what's Berto's favorite Christmas traditions? By the way, this episode is going to have some questions about psychology and many not. So deal with it.
Love it.
What's Berto's favorite Christmas traditions that he does with his kids? What are Berto's favorite Christmas traditions? And do his kids believe in Santa? And what is Santa getting them? So Berto, what's your favorite Christmas tradition?
All right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So Christmas for me plays a very, very big role in my life. Some of my favorite Christmas traditions I no longer do because they were traditions when I was a kid in Colombia, but they involved lighting fireworks, specifically sparklers, but lots of sparklers, like hundreds of sparklers. At midnight.
That's a Bogota thing?
That was a Bogota thing. So we would all go, the kids would go out in the street at
Christmas Eve?
Yeah, Christmas Eve, because there we celebrated. The big Christmas celebration was Christmas Eve.
Oh. In my family, it's kind of that way too, actually.
Yeah, and so we would have like presents already. At midnight, baby Jesus would leave your presents under your pillow. Hmm. And then afterwards, you would go out into the streets and party it up. And so we'd grab our sparklers.
Specifically,
and just go,
baby? Specifically, baby Jesus?
Yeah, baby Jesus.
Yeah, you've told me this before that your presents would be left under your pillow.
Under the pillow by baby Jesus.
All of your presents?
No, this was the special surprise from baby Jesus presents.
Oh, so yeah. Santa would be under the tree.
There was no Santa.
Oh.
So it was only baby Jesus.
Did you get other presents?
Yeah, adults would get us presents.
Oh, okay.
And then those would be, usually in our case, it would be on our grandma's bed. Everyone would come over to my grandma's house. The bed would get filled with presents. It was a sight to behold. And at midnight, on top of all that great goodness, baby Jesus would leave your special presents under your pillow.
Kind of like the tooth fairy or something.
Yeah.
So you'd go to bed. And
you wouldn't go to bed. You would go to your room at midnight and see what baby Jesus left you.
Oh, your parents didn't have to slip it under your
pillow. No, because, you know, they don't have to do anything. Baby Jesus would handle it.
And what did you get under the pillow?
Oh, my gosh. So one year I got this, you know, those Japanese robots, you know, kind of tall plastic robots.
I got one of those in the 70s.
Yeah, dude. Oh, I got one of those.
I got a giant one.
Oh, my gosh.
And I made my parents let me bring it to church that day because it was a Christmas on Sunday. And I wanted to bring it. My parents were like, you can't bring that to church. And I'm like, I want to bring it. And they gave in.
Dude, I got that one time. One time I got, I mean, obviously I got Star Wars stuff. Like, I think one time I got a Gamorrean guard, you know, or the Emperor or both or something. And I got a He-Man thing one time under there. And one time I was supposed to get a Godzilla. But they couldn't get a Godzilla, I guess. So I got this Kraken, which was a thing you squished down and pressed a little orange button so it stays squished. And it looked slightly like a Godzilla, but it was not a Godzilla.
Yeah, I wonder if kids today have a same feeling that we did, because there were so few things that you could play with.
You would be very specific. Like, I want this specific thing.
And there weren't that many things available.
Right.
Whereas today, I feel like the average, even lower middle class family, it's not hard to afford a fair amount of little toys and doodads for kids.
Yeah.
Also, I imagine young kids today, you tell me with your daughters that it's not necessarily about possessions, because there's so many other things that can entertain them. There's video games and TV shows and Netflix. And
especially it's gotten that way because over the years, there's this culture of abundance. So it's like, well, what do you want? I don't know. You know?
Yeah. I mean, so that's what your daughters will say?
A little bit.
Because they've already gotten everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
whereas as a kid, I'm like, what do I want?
I mean, yeah,
let me count the ways.
The list of what I wanted at Christmas was endless.
Yeah.
I mean, there were so many things that I wanted, you know. There were probably like 25 Atari cartridges that I wanted. Yeah. There were so many Star Wars things. There were music. I mean, just my music, right?
Right. Well, that's another thing. Nowadays, you don't get music.
Yeah, you don't need it.
You don't get movies either.
Yeah.
That's another thing that's changed, because many years ago, 5 years ago even, I might still ask for a movie. But
really? 5 years ago?
Or 7 years ago or something, right? Like, I used to ask for movies.
Wow.
Like, get me this Blu-ray, right?
Yeah.
Now, why would I ask for a movie? Yeah. I might ask for a gift certificate for iTunes or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, do your kids believe in Santa?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
Both of them?
Yeah.
Older one.
Why would they not believe in Santa? It's like, do we believe in the sun? Of course.
And what's Santa getting them?
Well, I don't know. I know what they've asked Santa.
What did they ask Santa?
Okay, my older kid wants a scooter. And I'm a little suspicious.
Like an unmotored scooter?
Like, I guess.
Like a Razor?
They didn't specify. I think it's a unmotored scooter.
Like a skateboard with a handle.
A skateboard with a handle, yes. And then they also want shoes with...
I mean, your street has a pretty good hill.
Yeah, yeah.
That could be fun.
And they also want shoes with wheels in them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They used to have shoes like that when they were younger, and then they outgrew them and they never got a replacement, so now they want them again. And then the little one wants a mermaid Barbie, a Barbie mermaid or something. And then wants another, like a makeup kit or something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
My little niece is learning how to play piano, and I bought her some Beatles, for children.
Nice.
Yeah, so.
That's sweet.
Grinning Cat on Discord. By the way, the official Psychology Show Discord has been terminated or closed or something. Terminated sounds bad, but... And there's a fan one, so I don't know how to find it exactly. Maybe someone can post a link below or something, but there's a fan version.
Yeah, I'm a member of the fan one.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, they post fun things there.
Grinning Cat on Discord, the old Discord, says, is the idea of U.S., of American exceptionalism a form of enmeshment? Is the idea of American exceptionalism a form of enmeshment? I will answer this question. So American exceptionalism, I'm sort of thinking out loud here. American exceptionalism is the idea or the paradigm or the cultural notion or the philosophy that America has always sort of been destined to be great and better than every other country in the world. And that a lot of things stem from that. Like, we have the best military and the best space program and the best national parks and the best government system and the best medical system. And as an extension of that, there's nothing wrong with having some sort of pride, but it denies the opportunity to learn from other societies. There are other societies that might try something out that we're not trying and might actually do a better job with it, like with income inequality, for example, right, or renewables.
Healthcare,
right. And there are things that you can learn from other countries. And for the person completely embedded within the American exceptionalism idea and, frankly, nationalism, they think that that's abhorrent to even entertain the idea that a European country or an African country or an Asian country could do anything better than America. And if you propose that, then get out of the country, love it or leave it, that kind of ridiculous. So is it a form of enmeshment? I mean, you could, I guess in a metaphoric sense, you could argue that the individuals who are adhering to that notion are enmeshed overly so with the nation, such that they can't differentiate and pull their head out of the ass of the MAGA troop to actually look at the rest of the world and wonder if maybe you have your head in someone's fucking ass. You think I'm a little upset about the politics of the United States? Sylvan says, Dr. Kirk, do you recall who you had who you had your first parasocial relationship with. Sylvan says, mine was Michael Jackson. I watched the Thriller concert special live on TV when I was little, and I was convinced I was going to marry him. My first parasocial relationship. I mean, that's, you know, Mr. Rogers, all the characters of Sesame Street, you know, Mighty Mouse. There were all sorts of characters that I watched on television. I'm going to say Mr. Rogers because of the way that show is engineered. It's specifically engineered.
Well, that would have to be mine too, for sure.
Okay.
I literally felt like he was in my life and he was my friend.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole reason for it.
Yeah.
Okay. So this next thing I want to talk with you, Berto, is about something I saw on Reddit about Will Smith and Chris Rock.
Ooh.
So they did a survey, not on Reddit, but on YouGov.org or com or something. So who knows what the sample was exactly. But they did ask a bunch of people on the internet, probably thousands of people, what are the average American's opinions about Chris Rock and Will Smith as of a couple months ago? So for Will Smith, what do you think the percentages are favorable versus unfavorable versus don't know? Because maybe some people don't know.
For Will Smith, I would still say probably 60% favorable, 30% unfavorable, 10% don't know.
Well, your don't know is pretty close, but favorable was 38%.
Only 38%?
Unfavorable, 46%.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
He did
himself a lot of damage then.
Yeah, jeez. What about Chris Rock?
Chris Rock, I'll go favorable 70. Maybe that's too high. Favorable 60, unfavorable 20.
Oh my God, 60-23.
Wow.
Good job. Opinions on Chris Rock versus Will Smith's actions during the Oscars. So what percentage of people said what Will Smith did was worse than what Chris Rock did? What percentage?
Oh, okay. I would go 60% thought Will Smith was worse.
Pretty close, 52. I find that to be low.
Yeah, I find that low.
You know, because or people don't understand what stand-up comics typically do.
Yeah, because I remember at the time the dialogue was like, well, but he made fun of his alopecia, of the wife's alopecia.
I mean, like, have you seen a modern comedy show? One, two, have you seen any of the award shows that have existed in the past 10 years?
Yeah.
I mean, there have been way worse jokes than that. Like,
especially considering,
100 times worse than
right,
that.
Especially considering that there was the joke wasn't even like, oh, look at her alopecia. No, it was like, because she had shaved her head,
yeah,
he made a G.I. Jane joke.
Yeah, that's not, you could argue it's complimentary, right?
Yeah.
That she looks badass or yep, something. Like, it's not saying she's some sort of hideous nope, monster. It's a G.I. Jane joke. And he literally said that, like, dude, it was a G.I. Jane joke.
Yeah.
Like, relax.
Yeah.
I wasn't saying, you know, what percentage said what Chris Rock did was worse?
Yeah, like 25%.
14%.
Good.
Both were equally wrong.
I'd say 30%.
22%.
Okay.
This is surprising, you know, because in terms of the way that everyone in my circle and
yeah,
certainly everyone on the internet that I see, it absolutely concludes that Will Smith's actions were
yeah,
way beyond. Even if some of the people will say, well, I feel like that joke was crossing the line, but
yeah,
certainly that doesn't deserve violence.
Right. even if, which I don't agree, but even if it was like, well, the joke was not in good taste, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah. And he was on the Daily Show with Trevor Noah, right? Is his name?
Yeah.
And by the way, one night in New York City, Stacy and I were at one really famous comedy club. I can't remember what it's called.
In New York City?
Yeah, there's a couple that are really, but there's one that's really famous. And I got us front row tickets. And so we're, you know, sitting in the front, like right up against the stage.
Mm.
And that night, So this is a famous club where famous comedians will just show up, and you know, and so a young Trevor Noah, before he was famous,
oh really,
was one of the openers, and he was hilarious. There was what's her name?
That's cool.
What's her name from SNL? She also does the Game of Thrones.
Is this called like The Cellar or something like that?
Comedy Cellar, is that something. The one? I can't remember her name, but she was on SNL and she was hilarious. She's the one who does the Game of Thrones reaction videos. She's really funny. There was the guy from Cash Cab, which apparently he also is a comedian. Did you ever see that show, Cash Cab? It was like a game show where he would do trivia. You never saw that show?
No, I don't think
so. It was a cab in New York, and he would drive around taking people from A to B. So these people would randomly get in his cab, and he'd say, oh, by the way, you're in Cash Cab, and while I take you from A to B, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions, and how many you get you right, then you get money. You know,
nice. Sort of.
And so that guy, and then Colin Quinn.
Oh, okay.
Was seemingly intoxicated.
But he was already famous by then.
Yeah. But he just, I think, randomly showed up and just was shopping around a 15-minute set that he was doing. And there were a few others, too. But it was, you know, star-studded night in New York City.
That's hilarious.
But why am I telling you that story?
Because Trevor Noah...
Oh, because Will Smith went on Trevor Noah. And people were asking me to react to it because I've been, you know, reacting to various different things of Will Smith. And I will say that post-slap, Will Smith's apology, which was 6 minutes long total on YouTube, and then his appearance on Trevor Noah, I just feel like he's not really addressing it. He's talking kind of about it, but it's not clear that he actually thinks he did something really bad. Yeah, I mean, he's using the right words. See, that's the thing. Like, it's this really good... I don't know, but I think he's using the right words. But to me, his demeanor and his... I don't know, the amount of attention for me, I would be more satisfied if he gave a lot more vulnerability and a lot more... words to what he went through, like, but he's very surface about the whole thing. Like, if you really watch what's being said, and you know, he doesn't owe me anything, and I don't think Chris Rock cares. I think he's just like, whatever. I mean, he's been that way from the beginning, at least publicly.
Yeah,
but to me, I would have liked Will Smith, and maybe one day he will, but I'm thinking he's not going to, for him to say something like, I have an issue with being bullied and abuse from my dad. And when my wife is being harmed in any way, even in fairly innocuous ways, it triggers my trauma from my dad and my mom. And I've been going through a lot lately because I wrote this book that I went into it for the first time, and I never talked about it openly. So it's kind of raw for me. And when he said that joke, I just saw red. It was like I was 10 years old again, and I was watching this man dominate and harm my mother/wife.
Yeah.
And I just lost complete control. I mean, not complete control, but it just felt like the right thing to do at the time. But when I look back, I'm like, what just happened? And, you know, I'm still recovering from my traumas, and I'm working on it. And I don't think that would happen again, because I've done a lot of work on that. And I feel like I now can predict triggers that are coming at me. So I can try to do some deep breathing instead of just like flying off the handle. It was also like a really insane night for me, because I was getting an Oscar and I was front row, and you know, I was in these interviews all day long, and I don't know, I was just kind of, my brain was a little frazzled. It's not an excuse, but I don't know, something like that.
Yeah,
but that's not what he says. What he says is, it's complicated, and I don't want to get into the specifics.
I watched part of that video, the YouTube apology.
Yeah,
and I guess I see what you're saying now that you're bringing it up. I did, when I was watching, I thought, okay, good, he's apologizing. So I fell for it, I guess,
but
right?
But that's what I'm saying. I think it's people fall for it because he says the words, I'm sorry, I apologize, I take full responsibility. But that's, and the more analyses that I do of these apologies, because I've been doing a lot, the more I realize that I think the PR people, because you know he talked with a PR person, that they figured out the formula. You say you take full responsibility, you say you apologize, right. You say the words, and you have a somber-looking face, but you don't have to take responsibility, really. You just say you take... I mean, you know, imagine, Berto, I steal your house.
Right.
And burn it down.
Yeah.
However that happens. And you find out that it's me, and I'm like, Berto, I just want to tell you that I take full responsibility for burning your house.
Okay.
And I apologize.
Oh, all right. Well, okay. Well, in that case...
Right. Like... Okay, good opener, good topic sentence. Now get to the body of the paragraph. Like, back it up with something.
Well, you don't want to go into specifics.
Yeah. Like, I'll buy you a new house. How about we start with that, right?
But, right. No, I mean, that's too specific. Let's just keep it at an apology.
So I feel like it's disappointing because, to me, I have a vision and, you know, I have... no idea who the real Will Smith is, but my vision of Will Smith is that he's better than that.
Yeah.
That he has the ability to do the right thing. I don't know the whole story, and maybe there's more to it, but I can't imagine there being anything that would justify what he did at all.
Right.
I can imagine a justification for hating the guy and having an ongoing resentment for him, fine, but not a justification for what he did. And even the way he did it, you know, it was, and the fact that they didn't kick him out and he didn't leave.
Yeah.
After committing a literal crime on national television.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was awful.
You know, because it would have been bad enough because it would have been assault still. Like, I imagine that, let's say Chris Rock finishes that segment and then they go to commercial or whatever they do. And then Will Smith gets up out of his chair, goes backstage and still punches him or hits him, whatever. That's still assault.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is this difference in like what Will Smith is trying to accomplish and how much in control he is of the situation. In that moment, he either forgot or it actually didn't care that he's in front of the world.
Right.
He's like, yeah, do, 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 boom. So he's like on autopilot.
Right.
Which is scary.
Yeah.
He's like, what else can you do on autopilot?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. If you were a comedian and Will Smith's in the audience, what else is he capable of, like, without any kind of explanation? Anyway, let's take a break. When we get back, more questions from listeners. What do you say?
Let's do it.
So, Berto, let's do an OPP. What do you say?
OPP.
These people became patrons all the way back in July of 2020.
Wow.
We have Gabrielle from Australia. Danny from Willoughby, Washington. Oh, no, that's Australia.
Willoughby, Australia?
Well, because it says WA.
Oh,
but
okay.
That must be Western Australia. That must be the state or province. Upper tier patron, Danny. Ines from Salt Lake City. Rachel from God knows where. Anna from Copenhagen.
Ooh.
Laura from Canada.
Nice.
Trash Panda.
Trash Panda.
From Oklahoma City. That's a mean parent. I mean, if you're Mr. and Mrs. Panda and you name your kid Trash, I mean, Josh from Tennessee, Pat and Kaylee from God knows where, Harriet from Australia, a lot of Australia. Patty from God knows where, San from Amsterdam, Max from, I think, Austria. Shane from Arizona, Audrey from God knows where, Elizabeth from California, Brianna from Tennessee, Gabriella. We have a Gabrielle and a Gabriella. We have Xenon from Singapore.
Whoa.
Oishi from Raleigh, North Carolina, and Ezra from God knows where. Thank you for becoming a patron.
Oh man, such diversity.
All the way back in July of 2020 in the midst of the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
All right, Berto. Christine on Patreon asks, "Hi, Dr. Anna. I'm not sure if Umberto has explicitly discussed this on the podcast before, but if he's comfortable, I would love to hear about his internal and interpersonal process of moving forward in his relationship with his mother after her abandonment. Was he ever no contact with her? Did he or is he, I think meaning that, did you ever reject contact with her?
Oh, I see.
Did he or is he still dealing with residual feelings of resentment? I'm especially curious because I grew up in a household of abuse by my mother and stepfather. I'm 30, and especially over the last few years as I've been in therapy, my relationship with my mother has become a central topic in my healing process." Berto, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely did not do no contact. As soon as I could see her again, I was so happy because it was like this giant gap in my soul. So, you know, seeing her again was definitely important. I didn't deal with it for years and years because I didn't really even know that there was something to be dealt with.
You moved back in with her when you were 15.
When I was 15, and I spent 3 years during high school.
And then when you went to college, you lived nearby, so you probably
lived
saw
an hour
her
away.
Saw her frequently.
Saw her with some frequency.
And no conscious resentment at the time?
Not that I remember, no. Yeah. I just kind of thought, oh, you know, this is life. This is what we do.
Yeah. Was it ever in your head that your mom had abandoned you at that point?
I don't remember, but it was
That's interesting. So, because it's so blatantly an abandonment.
Yeah, but it was certainly not a thing where I was like living with her and thinking about it, or
because you're four, right? She gives you an apple and she just disappears.
Almost three.
She sits you down in front of the TV.
Yeah.
Walks out, says, "I'm stepping out for a second."
Yeah.
Walks out the door, and you don't see or hear from her for years.
I think it was at least a year, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic abandonment. That's like from a movie or something, you know.
Yeah.
So at 18 years old, if I asked you, did your mom abandon you, what would you have said?
At 18, I mean, I probably would have said, well, I don't know. I might have said, well, I don't know. I wouldn't frame it that way, but she did leave when I was three.
Right.
And then I think what happened was, it was only when I was starting to go through therapy that I really started to internalize, like, oh, wait a minute. Like, that's massive.
Did you just think of it like, it's just a regular divorce, you know, things happen?
Probably, yeah. I mean, as a kid, I do remember often asking my dad, like, wait, why can't the two of you get back together? Which is very natural, you know. But I don't remember ever thinking of it in a weird way, like, well, yeah, my parents are divorced, but not normal divorce. Yeah.
I mean, when you're three, you just think, well, this is how the world works.
Yeah, and then even later, like, I don't remember. I remember me thinking that, yes, my parents are divorced, and that's the end of that story. It wasn't like, but there's this weird story of what happened to me.
So then in therapy, when you're in your 30s?
Yeah, early, like when I turned 30, really.
And did the therapist say something, or what happened?
It was not that obvious at first, but as we were working through things, obviously the narrative came out, you know, about what had happened in that sense. But it wasn't like immediately like, aha, well, that explains everything. You know, it was more like over the years.
I'm guessing for your therapist, they felt that way.
But. Yeah, but she was really, so one of the things that I thought was very effective is she was never the kind to be like, oh, wait. What did you just say? Okay, well, that's the clue to all your life.
Okay.
You know, instead, it was more that whenever we would talk about things, she often would ask me, like, how are you feeling right now? A lot of it was like, how am I feeling right now? So whenever I would say, well, something about my mom, it was usually because I had actually either had a fight with her or something bubbled up to the surface.
Something present.
Yeah.
She wouldn't say, tell me about your childhood.
No.
It would be something emotionally relevant.
Right. And then we would talk about, you know, my childhood, but it was, in fact, my inclination at first when I started going to therapy was, oh yeah, let me just narrate to you my entire life. Cause I saw it as like, cool, someone's going to sit here and listen to me, just tell them everything. And she actively discouraged that in the sense of like, well, that's great, but I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with you right now. How are you feeling? All these things. And that always made me so uncomfortable at first because I was like, what? I don't want to feel. I don't want to talk about how I'm feeling. You know? But yeah, so over the years, I started making these connections with the guidance of the therapy of like, oh, whoa, wait, I'm doing this weird random looking behavior that's very self-destructive. But maybe I'm just looking for my mom, or maybe I need that warmth. I need that approval. I need that thing.
So did you get angry at your mom eventually?
Yeah, dude, there were a couple of times where
I knew you during one of the events.
Yeah, I was very drunk and I got irrationally like a little 3-year-old upset at her. It wasn't
meaning
in front
that
of her.
You were really
it was rage, yeah, total rage.
Yeah.
And
where were you? Like downtown?
I was being driven, but then eventually I got out of the car and I started destroying a tree, like a small tree.
Right. You told me that story.
So I was so upset.
Where were you when you got out of the car?
That was in, I think that was in Kirkland or Redmond.
Oh, okay.
Maybe Redmond or something. And it was, oh, I remember that rage, just rage. Like I could have killed someone, you know? I was taking it out on a tree. And I felt so sorry for the tree in my drunken state. I was crying.
Did you
for
hurt
the tree? Yeah, because I was like ripping branches and stuff.
Did you drive by it again later and see?
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember.
Be interesting to go back to that tree.
Yeah. Oh man, I don't even know where exactly it was, but I think I did. I feel like I did see it again, but. Anyways, it was a thing that I hadn't experienced before, you know, like these. And then I've had a couple of conversations with her, but nothing ever.
I thought you had some drag out yelling match with her one time.
Yeah, but not about it.
But it was, but it wasn't. What weren't you angry at her for not?
This
being
was related
attentive?
To my uncle, and this is when you know how my uncle owed me a lot of money, and then she was trying to get me to go to Columbia and deal with it, and I got so upset, so I yelled at her and I stormed out and I slammed her front door on the way out and broke it.
Broke it how?
You know, the
door
hinge,
jam?
The door jam, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, the way I, because I think I knew you.
Yeah, this was
late, this is late 30s.
2008.
Yeah.
Or 9 at the latest.
And I remember you telling me, I remember we were in your basement and you're telling me about it.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think anyway, interpreting it as, well, obviously your anger about her abandoning
right.
you was starting to come out.
Right. Right.
And it was, and I remember you really, you were very, very angry at her.
Yeah.
And you wondered if you would ever talk to her again.
Yeah.
And you didn't talk to her for a month or something.
Yeah. It was, I was very upset.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
so
hard.
Because you now see her all the time.
And yeah.
She has a relationship with your kids and.
Yep.
And you're very cordial and.
Yeah. Well, so a couple of things. One of them is that she has been a really great grandma. And in the process, she has become a lot more warm and. Affectionate, if you will, even to me, I mean. But then also part of me, I think at some point decided that there's some battles I want to fight and some battles I don't want to fight. And I had as close as I could have gotten to a conversation with her. And at the time, I think it was more cathartic for her than it was for me. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm ever going to get exactly what I want here.
What do you mean?
You know, because it was her trying to get things off her chest. But I felt underwhelmed. You know, I was like, well, that's great. But
like she was she crying?
No. See, it wasn't that moment. It wasn't the, I can't believe
what I did. So it was more like. I want to tell you what I was going through.
Exactly.
And and poor me. And maybe poor
justified me at the very least.
And maybe poor her, but yeah. also yeah. to a much larger extent.
Right. And so we had that. That was many years ago. And I, at the time, I thought, well, okay. And it was shortly after that that I had one of those rage-filled incidents, one of them, because there was more than one. And I just got this sense of like, I don't know if she'll ever get it. Mm. Like, I just don't think she's got what it takes inside of her to actually get it. Mm. The thing for me is that I find the idea of leaving my child impossible, right? It's like a physical impossibility.
Yeah, yeah.
So therefore, I'm like, well, I know I get it because I have that just intrinsically. Yeah. I don't think she has, there's a little piece missing.
Yeah.
And it's and again, I understand, she had a traumatic childhood of her own and she all these things. So as a result, I think after that, I thought, well, I could spend the rest of my life chasing after this, but I don't know if it's actually, especially now that I'm a father and all this.
Because you could have written her out of your life, you know.
Right, I could have gone that route, but that would hurt me a lot.
Yeah.
So I think where we landed is that, well, she shows my family a lot of affection, more than she ever did, and loyalty, and I think my
consistency
and consistency.
Well.
And she has been, to be fair, she has been one of the sources of actual stability in my life after the egregious instability. So I kind of net out on like, well, I'll take what I can get.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so you have conceptualized it as she's not choosing to not understand. She has something different about her biology or personality or trauma or something that makes it just a blind spot. She just can't see it.
And that maybe through the right amount of therapy and the right amount of interventions, maybe the right amount of me withhold. I don't know, right? Like maybe there's a way to engineer it to where like finally a gestalt in her. But, you know, I'm almost 50. Like I just...
And your pathway was long and bumpy.
Yeah.
Lots of therapy, lots of emotions, lots of anger, lots of talking, lots of feeling and interacting and wrestling. And in the end, or at this phase, this is where you're at. You've been in this phase for 10 years or so, right?
That's right.
And, people out there, listeners out there could take a different route if they wanted to. I think the key about your current situation and the past 25 years with your mom is that she hasn't repeated the offense, right?
Right.
Whereas some people in this situation will have a parent that will continue to repeat the offense in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, you're trying to reconcile or have that balance that you've struck where it's like, well, I'll take the good with the bad. Meanwhile, you're continually being re-traumatized. You know, imagine if she every once in a while just didn't show.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like completely flaked on you and your kids or something. And that would be a different story, right?
No, that's a great point that after she came back into my life, that's true. You know, she was there and then it always had an emotional distance because of her just psychology, but she definitely did not re-traumatize me in that sense of like, okay, now I'm not going to be there again. Whereas, you know, I've had my own set of ongoing trauma, if you will, with my dad, where that, you know, that's stabilized in its own way. But I do think if it hadn't been for my family in Colombia, things would have been a lot worse for me.
Yeah, I'm quite positive. The people that I've treated and I've seen that where you'll see really terrible abandonment and mistreatment, but they had a grandma who was always there for them. In your case, grandma, but also a lot of other extended.
A lot of characters, grandmas, grandma's sister, my grandpa, my other grandpa, my uncles, my aunts, a huge network of people that love me that were counteracting.
Yeah, and that's important to point out, because when you have an isolated American culture that values materialism and mobility, you have a lot of parents who have no one in their town.
Totally.
And are when anything bad happens, there's no one there to make up for the deficits. Anonymous Separateer, what I want to close with, Berto, is I want to say that you provide a good model for people out there, because I think that a lot of people are earlier on in their process than you and can really wonder, like, well, where's the resolution? Because I'm beating my head against the wall trying to get my parent to admit what they did was wrong or to change their ways, and they're not doing it. And I'm ruminating on it. But
yeah.
And I'm sure at some point you were as well, but at some point you got to a place where you were able to, well, I'm guessing you also found a lot of love and security and validation from other individuals.
That's right, yeah.
Right, it wasn't just you were alone going, I validate myself.
Yeah.
Therapy, your wife, others.
And friends too, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that was a close second to your mom validating, right,
yeah,
fully. It's not the best, but it's pretty close, good enough, you know, life.
It helps.
Life has its ups and downs.
Yeah, totally.
Anonymous Separateer patron, she says, I am currently in a relationship with my partner of 4 years who is a white male of French nationality.
Mm.
4 years, white male. I am often annoyed when he gives me lengthy explanations of what is happening in my office and gives me advice on what to do. When he gives me lengthy explanations, I am inclined to call it mansplaining, but mansplaining. And I want to dismiss him. However, I realize that I don't really understand the exact definition of man-explaining.
Of a man-explaining.
I also am aware that some racial factors might be at play, such as that he's a white male and I am an East Asian Japanese woman. I feel that often the advice he gives me is not acceptable for me, as I feel I am not allowed to speak up as an Asian woman, or if I do, I will be further bullied or understood as a self-righteous woman. I know that he is genuinely trying to help me, but I'm afraid he might not fully understand my perspective. Berto, what do you think?
I definitely don't like the term mansplaining, but I get what it's the sentiment. You know, I get this idea of condescension and like, oh, let me help you out because, and I understand that historically there would be more of this emphasis on like, well, I'm the man of the house, so let me try to explain it in words you can understand, and that would be sexist. I get all that. I just don't like the term because I guess I've been a quote unquote victim of being explained to condescendingly.
Yeah, well, the term that people are using is to splain.
To splain, yeah.
So it's regardless of gender.
Yeah, if you take that out, then yeah, that makes sense. And so then if you're sitting there, and look, I've been guilty of this plenty throughout my life, of splaining. But I've also been victim of being splained too.
Yeah.
I think people in general just don't like being condescended, you know, be condescended to. And because you feel that they're trying to imply that you're a little slow or dumb or something, or maybe you can't speak up for yourself. And that never feels good.
Yeah. Well, I like the term mansplain. I also totally have been splained too, and I appreciate the more general term of splaining.
Yeah.
But I think the term mansplain is relevant and justified given the amount, you objectively somehow count the amount of splain moments that are happening to human beings in Seattle. And I'm going to take a guess and say that 90% are happening from men to women. And so the term mansplain, I think, is justified in that way. I don't think it's like 51-49 is my guess. Now, I can't know that, of course, and it's just anecdotal. And
I mean, maybe that's my bias because I don't see it, and so therefore I'm like, yeah, I don't know. But
yeah, but you ask the average woman, particularly if she works at an office with a fair amount of men, she will tell you that it happens a dozen times a day. And it's a phenomenon that is obvious and it happens. Can men be explained to? Yeah, absolutely. But so there's that. Two, for men to, well, anyway, I think the term is fine. Can it be abused? Yes, I've absolutely seen women accusing men of mansplaining when that is not what's happening. You know, the man is saying something that's true or something, and she just doesn't like it, and she's claiming she's being mansplained to. Mm-hmm. That happens as well, and it's annoying because it's subverting or bastardizing a well-meaning, well-intentioned term to justify their defensiveness and or their own narcissism or something. And it's I don't know. It's particularly bothersome. It's like when white people are, or when Christians are saying there's a war on Christmas and they're being discriminated against because they're Christians. And it's just like, you know,
right
now, can a Christian be discriminated against? Yeah, it happens. But to, as a whole of the United States, it's like, oh no, you're going from a 75% monopoly to a 72%.
Sure.
And we're, it, you know, requiring you to follow the fucking Constitution of the United States and right. the law of the land, which is that it's, you know, you can't put the Ten Commandments out front of a government building, you idiots. Put it out in front of a church if you want to, fine, but not in front of a government building. I mean, what would you think if we put the Quran on a stone tablet in front of a you know, municipal building? Like, how would you feel about that one? Like, if that's completely on the up and up. So anyway, there's that. But what I'll say to you, anonymous upper-tier patron, I don't know, but it sounds like you're saying you're Japanese, he's French, he's white, and he is often splaining to you and mansplaining, and he's often giving you, you say you're often annoyed when he gives you lengthy explanations of what's happening in your office. I'm guessing that you're coming home and telling him what's happening, maybe complaining, which is common. And he is giving you lengthy explanations and lecturing you about what you're supposed to do and what's happening. And yeah, a lot of women, and really everyone, but a lot of women have been in your shoes before. And what's happening, in all likelihood, usually when people go into these modes, is they're having some form of anxiety. So he hears your story and he worries about your well-being or worries that you're being trounced upon or something, and he doesn't know what to do with that anxiety, so he channels it into splaining, into narcissistic, sexist control, essentially. And then he starts to generate an agenda without knowing the situation. He barely understands it through your eyes, and he thinks he knows the answer, but he's jumping to something because he wants you to not be suffering. He wants you, you know, there could be something else too, like he really doesn't want you to quit your job or something. And so he doesn't know what's happening for him. And if he were, and when I've worked with clients like this, if he were to actually be able to just say, honey, when you tell me that story about work, it scares me because I, and it hurts me because I see you suffering, and I have this impulse to fix it and to tell you what to do, but I know that that's not helpful, and I don't even know if you want me to do that, but I love you, and I care about you, and I worry about you, and I feel powerless, and I'm really angry at your boss, and you know, and I don't know what to do with it. You let him, and you get him to stick with that, then a lot of spouses will appreciate it. Thank you for caring about me. Thank you for worrying about me. Thank you for hating my boss. I hate him too. But, and thank you for not lecturing me for you know, 90 minutes about what I'm supposed to do, because I don't need advice right now. I don't think you know even enough information to know what I should be doing. I just want to be able to complain and have you validate my feelings.
Right.
That's all I'm fucking looking for, you know? And culturally speaking, if it, you know, Japanese people and women in particular are socialized to not speak up and to not talk back, not all the time. I mean, you know, Japanese culture is pretty varied. And so, but generally speaking, you know, there's this message given to women in general and to Japanese women also. But so, you know, I don't know what's happening for you precisely, but that's what I'll say about that. Let's take a break. Bert will get back. More emails. What do you say?
Let's do it.
So, Berto, if you were to mansplain to the audience right now, to those people who aren't patrons, and make them be patrons, what would that sound like?
Well, let me try to put it in words that you could understand. The thing is, Andy, look, there's nothing wrong. These things can get really complicated, so I get it. You're a busy woman or person, and you have dishes to do, and lots of chores around the house, and so you don't have time to like really understand the internet or how things work at all. So what I'll say is this: I'll keep it pretty simple. Basically, there are these things called patrons. Patrons are the things that support the thing you like listening to. I know you think it comes from thin air and it's free and you don't have to do anything, but it's not quite that simple. So if you want to actually help, which, you know, some people do, then it's, you know, you have to press a button or two to become a patron. Now, I'm not going to expect that you're going to know how to do all this, but I would gladly send you detailed instructions in an email where you can follow them step by step. And if steps are not your thing, I can draw little pretty pictures. Maybe pretty little pictures is what you need so you can actually figure out how to become a patron. But anyways, whatever, you know. And don't feel bad. Lots of people get confused about a lot of things. So you're in good company, kiddo.
God, yeah. I wonder how many people are throwing their phones right now. All right, Berto. Upper tier patron Alyssa from Los Angeles, she asks, what do you think was the best band to come out of Seattle? And she says, it doesn't have to be a grunge band. So, Berto, who do you think was the best band to come out of Seattle?
I mean, you're so much better equipped to answer this question. But I will say I was very, very partial to Soundgarden. Hmm. I love me Soundgarden. Ooh, Chris Cornell, the rhythms in their songs were always super interesting to me. Especially since I was a budding musician at the time, I was always listening and going, "What? Well,
and
what are they playing?"
Past a certain album, their harmonic structures were really complicated.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Even though they're using a lot of distorted guitars and whatnot,
right.
the complication, yeah. The drummer, Matt Cameron, I believe. The bassist is an amazing. Kim Thiel's the guitarist.
The guitar. Oh, okay. What's the bassist?
And he's South Asian.
I love that bass.
Yeah, the bassist Shepherd is his name.
Oh my gosh, so good.
He is an amazing songwriter as well. Yeah. They're kind of like the Beatles, or Led Zeppelin in that. The writing is spread out,
right?
Or Queen, right? There's a
right,
and the singing is spread out sometimes too, yeah. Especially in the later albums. But yeah,
they stood out to me because they didn't just feel like moody grunge. You know, it was a lot more to it.
No, yeah, Super Unknown, Down on the Upside. These two albums are some of the best music that's ever been recorded. It is so amazing. I mean, the stuff I've recently started listening to it again, but yeah, my two, Soundgarden is my favorite.
Oh, nice.
I would also put Band of Horses up there, although some people don't consider
Band of Horses of Seattle.
I mean,
wow.
I think of all the places that claim them, I think Seattle claims them the hardest.
I thought they were Canadian for some reason.
No, the singer's from, I think, Georgia or something, but I think they got their start in Seattle or something, but I don't know. I don't think I would, of the Seattles that are associated with Seattle, I would say Band of Horses, Soundgarden, but of the Seattle bands, quote unquote, I wouldn't call Band of Horses a Seattle band.
Sure,
I would, but Soundgarden is absolutely a Seattle band. I mean, I played in clubs that Soundgarden played.
Yeah.
You know, I played in clubs like a year or two after they would have played there, you know, and they completely got their start in Seattle, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, other honorable mentions are Sunny Day Real Estate.
Oh, yeah. My brother was a huge Sunny Day fan.
Yeah. I mean, I when I listened back to that album, there are some rough moments, but at the time, it was just mind-blowingly good.
Yeah.
Foo Fighters.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
The first two albums are some of
actually, so I love the Foo Fighters, but mostly their old stuff because something happened along the way where what's his name? David Grohl started yelling more.
Yeah, I mean, he's always yelled, but I find the songwriting to be a little, I don't know, just predictable or something.
Yeah, but the early songs, I felt like his voice, he wasn't
trying
to be so angsty or something. I don't know.
Well, I think he's recorded a lot of music
past
the first two albums, and I think that there's a lot of variability. But, and I have to admit, I haven't really delved into those other albums, but the first two albums, you know, the first Foo Fighter and then Color and the Shape, are, I listened to those two albums on repeat.
It's so good.
From 95 to 97, especially for the time, because, you know, at the time it was a lot of Creed and
I know
other Limp Bizkit and a bunch of other crap. And
it stood out in a great way.
Yeah. Heart is a...
Right!
Yeah. I've recently got more into old Heart, and there are, I didn't realize this, like 8 Heart songs that I know beat for beat, word for word, note for note, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
Dog and Butterfly, Barracuda, even their later 80s stuff. What About Love? You know, all that stuff. It's great. Another band that I love, love, love is called Flop. And
Flop?
I don't even think they're on YouTube or Spotify, but they were big in Seattle. They were kind of like Green Day, like an early Green Day.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then another band called Hammerbox.
Oh, I know Hammerbox.
Yeah. The woman, the singer.
I worked with Carrie, the guitarist.
Carrie Acree. Oh, really?
Yeah. Harris Thurman.
My guitarist in my band bought his head, his Marshall head, his preamp.
Yeah.
And we played with it live.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. So Hammerbox was late 80s, early 90s, and Carrie Acree, the singer, was a barista on UW campus.
Oh, nice.
And so we would be, okay, you order something, you know, so we can talk to her. But I don't know. I just want to rattle off a list of all the Seattle associated acts that are great, that I just want to have on the list. Jimi Hendrix, Postal Service, Death Cab for Cutie. Love Death Cab for Cutie. Of course, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Mother Love Bone, Mudhoney, Black Tones, my friend's band, Black Tones, you know, said.
Right.
Plastic Poly, another great Seattle band. L7, Tad, Fleet Foxes, really great band, Fleet Foxes. We actually used to practice right next to them. Green River, Fastbacks. Fastbacks are just a proto Seattle band. That's really good. Modest Mouse, of course.
Were the Melvins from here?
I don't think so.
Okay.
They're from here, yeah. Modest Mouse, Temple of the Dog, Candlebox, if you remember.
Yeah.
Taco Cats, which is a modern
Taco
band.
Taco Cats?
The Presidents of the United States of America.
Oh, Pusa!
Not a fan. Lump, I really like, but the rest of it, I just found to just be like...
Millions of peaches.
God.
Peaches for free.
What an annoying song.
Peaches,
I mean,
come
I respect
from
it. Now, that guy had another band called the Giraffes.
Uh-huh.
And it was purposely goofy that I actually kind of liked because it was sort of...
I mean, he's very talented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Sonics from back in the day in the 60s, Fabulous Wailers from the 60s, Sleater-Kinney, of course.
Wow.
Macklemore, of course, which, you know, what are you going to do?
Ooh, Queensryche.
Queensryche, Brandi Carlile.
Silent Lucidity.
Quincy Jones, Ray Charles, Sir Mix-a-Lot.
What?
Dave Matthews.
Wait, did you say Quincy Jones?
Yeah, he got his start in
what?
Seattle.
What?
Yeah. The Ventures from back in the day. Bing Crosby, he's from Tacoma.
Oh, my gosh.
Kenny G, of course.
What a music tradition.
The band Brad. The Head and the Heart, which I knew some of those fellas and ladies. Blue Scholars is a hip-hop outfit.
Wow.
And there are many others, but those are all on my list.
It's amazing.
So, Berto, we still have questions from the 14th anniversary show.
Oh, really?
So let's finish them, God damn it.
Oh, my gosh. I got to look this up.
Anonymous patron asks, do you plan to do a deep dive on any social personality disorder? And my answer is absolutely. I plan on doing a deep dive on all of the personality disorders that I have not yet done a deep dive on, and I haven't done a deep dive on any social. And after I'm done with all the personality disorders, including the ancillary personality disorders that are no longer included in the DSM, I actually want to go back and redo a bunch of them because I've learned more and want to revise, like the narcissism deep dive, blah, blah. Traven is a patron and says, have any of the hosts ever been ice skating or horseback riding? Berto.
Okay. Definitely ice skating. I used to love, as a little kid in New York City, ice skating with my dad. They would play Magic, you know, Olivia Newton-John, ELO. And I loved it. It was just so fun. I could always feel like, you know, I was 5 years old or something, but I felt like I was floating in the air and I could go so fast. It was magical. Since then, I've done it a few times, not a lot. More recently, I've been roller skating with my girls, and I enjoy it, but it's
at
not quite as...
rink? Or?
Yeah, at the rink, roller okay. skating at the rink. It's not quite as magical as ice skating. As far as horse riding, no, I fear horses. I don't like them.
They're scary animals.
That said, my daughter takes horse riding once a week.
Really?
Yeah, fancy. My older daughter. My younger did not like it.
Yeah, so I've been ice skating, I don't know, maybe 10 times in my life. There's an ice rink in North Seattle that I've been to, like I said, about 10 times. You know, maybe once every 5 years, for some reason, it'll happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's fun. I'm terrible, but I manage. Horseback riding, only a few times, but the first time, I grew up with a lot of horses, you know, in Sammamish,
right.
Washington. It was pretty rural back then, very rural back then.
But your parents didn't have a horse.
No, right? But horses were right next door. I had friends that would ride horses, you know, that had horses and had farms, and that was their whole thing, was riding their horses. But I don't know why, it just never happened. It seems like it would have happened at some point, but it just never did until I was, so in church, I was in a youth group, a youth group, and we did these like charity things every summer. And one summer we went out to Montana to build a sport court for this rehabilitation home for teenagers that had committed crimes, and instead of going into prison, they were eligible for this program in which they went to a farm.
Okay.
And it was 1,000 acres in Montana.
Whoa.
And we went there, and our youth group was, I don't know, maybe like 7-8 people, and the convicted teenagers were maybe same, like maybe 8 mm-hmm. people. And we worked on building the sport court, like a basketball court for them. And we stayed on the farm and lived in the, you know, the manor with all the kids that were there and we bonded with a lot of the kids that were there because of crimes they had committed. And they purposely didn't tell us what crimes they committed until we were driving away. And they were some pretty horrendous crimes. I mean, imagine what sort of crime as a 16-year-old would land you in some sort of permanent facility for 12 months. But one of the activities that we did, I remember, was, and I would have been like 12 or 13, was riding horses. And they just had this stable, not a stable, but just this fenced off area with like 20 different horses. And they just randomly matched me with this one horse. And I get on the horse and they open up the gate. And my horse just bolts.
Oh my God, no.
And they haven't told me anything.
No.
There's been no instruction. And it's such a Montana,
oh my gosh,
80s thing that everyone's laughing, right?
Oh.
And I had it was just like it was yesterday, the mixture of feelings I had as this horse just gallops through the, and it was this, it wasn't a tiny, you know, this field was like I said, 1,000 acres.
Yeah.
So it was just an open prairie
that he's
running. And I had absolute terror because horses are giant creatures and pure muscle.
Yeah.
And when they're running, it's kind of hard to hold on.
Right.
And it feels like you're gonna die, but at the same time, 50% of me was having the most euphoric, you know, like, I don't know what kind of feeling, just ecstasy, just like flying through. Because, yeah, I'd never, I couldn't drive a car or anything or fly an airplane. Yeah, it felt like I was just suddenly flying an airplane.
Oh, my God.
And I was giggling, but utterly terrified. And the horses headed straight for the stump because it's kind of this wild prairie field thing. It was on the foot of this big mountain that we actually went up into eventually. We just went like through the woods. It was like being in the movie of True Grit or something. We're like, you know, it was really like that. But we're heading for this stump, and I've talked about this in the podcast before. And the stump is quickly getting closer to us, and I'm like, we're dead. We're going to crash into this massive tree stump, and we're going to die, and this is how I die. And at the last moment, of course, the horse, because it's a
human being.
It's a sentient animal, decides to not hit the stump, and it obviously but it still runs past the stump. And in that moment, my life is flashing before my eyes, and I'm like, oh, yeah. Like this, I can depend on this horse.
The horse is trying to not die.
My life is sort of tied to this animal. Like it doesn't want to die, and thus I'm safe as long as I just hold on. So
that's incredible.
That literally might be the only time I ever. No, maybe at like a fair, like where you just go around a circle or something. But yeah, I mean, usually you don't. You can own a horse your whole life and never have the opportunity to just run through an open prairie. Like, you know, you're in the old West or
Legends
something.
Of the Fall.
Like that was a very special experience. And I had it within the first second of getting on my very first horse.
That's incredible. So my story is so undramatic and so sad. I went to Ocean Shores with my girlfriend in high school, one of my girlfriends in high school. And she had it in her heart that we were going to ride horses and do go-karts or something.
The go-karts at Ocean Shores were legendary in my family.
Right. Well, I was a wuss, and so I didn't want to do the darn horses, and it broke her heart. And I think that's when she lost interest in me.
Wah-wah.
Yeah.
All right. Patron Willow from Oregon says, have you ever been dared to eat gross food combinations? If so, what?
Yeah, totally. I mean, dared? I mean, I've eaten gross food combinations.
Yeah, I don't think you need to be dared.
First of all, I've eaten at those restaurants. I've eaten at a restaurant in Tampa that specializes in, quote, weird foods. So like kangaroo meat, alligator meat, snake.
But that's nothing. Like those sort of meats are, especially if they're kind of ground up into a hamburger patty or
the snake wasn't, but it tasted like tuna. But in Colombia I've eaten ants, you know, culones, which are these ants with big butts.
In Seattle there was a period of time where they sold chocolate covered ants in the 80s.
Oh, there you go.
And in my family we would eat those ants. Yeah.
And then I've also had
as a novelty,
I've had cricket.
Yeah, I think cricket too.
But, you know, gross, like a live worm or something. Yeah. Like, I haven't.
No.
No.
Well, for me, the thing that comes to mind is durian.
Oh, but I'd eat durian for breakfast.
But have you had it?
Yeah.
Oh, have had durian.
I've had durian shakes, which I love.
Oh, okay. Well, you've had durian mixed in with things.
But I've also had raw durian, it smells terrible, but I still like it.
Oh.
Yeah.
It tastes like onions and bad socks. I mean, it's not pleasant, and it has a slimy texture.
Yeah.
It's not good.
I you know what happens though is because in my mind it's healthy, so I'm like, yeah, it's good for you.
Patron Brick House asks,
Brick House,
coffee or tea, what kind and how often? Berto,
there's part of me that would love to drink, you know, pure coffee every day, but the caffeine really does not do me good. So I drink decaf, not every day, but when I can, I drink decaf. But I've become a really big tea fan lately. I drink hibiscus tea, hibiscus with blueberry. I'm also a fan of chamomile.
Non-caffeinated?
Non-caffeinated, yes.
Yeah.
I go for non-caffeinated.
I am definitely a coffee person. I've tried to be a tea person. There's a real fancy tea shop down by Pike Place that you can go up to the bar and like try various different Chinese teas and like do taste tests, and they give you this real fancy like steeper, or I don't know what you call it, but so I've gone through periods of time with tea, and I feel like tea either makes me feel like I'm just drinking tainted water or it actually sometimes makes me feel kind of sick. I feel like I've gone through periods of time where I want to be a tea person.
But you can't be.
I mean, for the health. And
but isn't your mom like Brit? Aren't you like Brit?
No.
Half Brit or something? Or is your mom half, she's not half Brit or something?
No. My mom?
Yeah, or is she half German?
No. She's an eighth Swedish. But yeah, I'm a huge coffee person. I've been a coffee person ever since I was 18-ish or so. I didn't drink any coffee in high school as a kid.
I drank coffee growing up.
Oh, really?
Because
Columbia.
Kids drink coffee.
Yeah. But back in the day, in the 80s, in the United States, I think it was pretty rare. I feel like in the 80s, the teenagers who drank coffee, they were like super cool. They probably smoked cigarettes too, you know? but I feel like today, it's not uncommon to have a 15-year-old having a latte or something in Seattle. That wasn't the case back in the day.
I mean, growing up, a typical breakfast for me as a kid, like a 10-year-old, let's say, would be coffee with milk.
So would you be kind of jacked up a little bit?
No, I mean, it was weak coffee. It wasn't. But maybe I was a little jacked, but it was weak coffee with milk.
And did you get addicted?
Bread and no.
I mean,
well, my dad drinks a lot of coffee. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone through different phases with coffee where, like, there was a time when I would make my own coffee in a percolator, like an old school percolator, and I would drink the entire pot, which was probably 9 cups of coffee throughout, and I would drink coffee until late at night because,
oh my God,
at least in my mind, it helped me to stay awake with clients. Yeah. Clients didn't put me to sleep, but when you're sitting for 10 hours a day, and you know, you get a little tired sometimes, and the coffee would, you know, definitely keep me up raring to go. And I'd fall asleep fine, you know, like it was weird. But as I got older, coffee started having more effect on me. So now sometimes I go through bouts where I'm like, I just need to stop drinking, and I stop. But currently I'm in a 1 cup of coffee a day, and I love, it's always black, never, especially sugar. I mean, you could put a little bit of cream to my coffee that'll be okay, but I'd rather not. I do not understand sugar in coffee or tea. It's disgusting to me. People love it with sugar, and it's repulsive.
As a kid, I loved it, especially because I would pretend, since the coffee with milk was a little like arequipe color, which is like caramel color, and I would add the sugar, and so I'd pretend I was eating caramel, you know?
and also, the typical coffee that you get in a restaurant like a Denny's or something, or a hotel, is the typical coffee is really watery to me,
right?
And you would think that, well, you know, it's just kind of weak coffee. You just maybe drink 2 cups of it or something, but it actually can make me feel nauseous. It's weird.
Yeah.
Like I need it to be this. Like Starbucks makes, a lot of the places in Seattle make the sort of coffee I'm looking for. I'm looking for a real rich, chocolatey, dark, powerful, you know, you cannot see through it sort of coffee.
Yeah.
And it has to be the perfect temperature too as well. Like I hate things being too hot. Like you'll go to Starbucks, you get a cup of coffee and...
Right.
Yeah, it could literally be 20 minutes before I can drink it. And I can't even hold it because even with the protector, it's
too hot.
It's too hot, yeah. And to stand there with the coffee, you know, you wanted it, you stood in line, yeah. and you can't drink it. And so inevitably, so you try it and you burn your mouth. But then there's this narrow window where it's okay to drink and it's perfect, and then it'll quickly become so yeah. sort of lukewarm that I it's disgusting to me. So actually, I discovered, of course, that there's a thing called a tumbler, which is like a little thermos. Oh. And actually, we sell them at part of Psychology nice. Seattle merch. And so we got some samples, and I've been using those every day. Nice. And it keeps it warmer longer.
And this whole thing for 14 years has been one elaborate commercial for the tumbler.
Yeah. Agnieszka, patron Agnieszka, says, "What does Umberto do for a living, actually? His introductions are a bit confusing."
Introductions right? to what? I don't understand.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I haven't gone into it a lot, into a lot of detail, but basically, you know, sometimes people need mist in their life, and it's kind of weird. I think as the weather has changed because of climate warming or global climates, people change the amount of moisture that they need in their life, and also when you get sick. You know, when you get sick, mm-hmm. your body needs different things. Mm-hmm. And that's not even counting, like, there's people that grow up in different parts of the world next to waterfalls and those thermals, you know, the thermals. Mm-hmm. So it takes all kinds is what I'm saying, really.
You've talked about it a billion times.
Yeah.
I don't know what this person is. Patron David says, if you left psychology today, what profession would you laterally transfer into? Well, I will answer that I don't know what that would be because I, you know, it's not like I could slip into programming or becoming a professional football player or something, you know, because I don't have any qualifications. But one thing that I do have qualifications for, strangely now, is a content consultant, which I actually am hired occasionally as a content consultant. Like a, I don't know what you call it, but a consultant yeah. to help a podcast or a YouTube channel. Because since this is basically a one person operation, me, Stacy helps, but it's been me, you know, 99% of what's happened.
Right.
And the decisions and the knowledge.
You know, and the ins and outs.
Yeah. There's so many ins and outs. You know, it's like if a news channel had just one employee. Like imagine right. all the things you would know about the cameras and the right. television stations and the how to give a news presentation and how to do the weather. You know, you learn so much, and there's so many things to do. And of course, success hinges on a fair amount of
right.
expertise and decision making and wisdom. And so, and given how many upstart podcasts and YouTube channels that there are out there, and it would be gratifying to me because could get behind the project, you know, yeah. like there are projects that I help out sometimes, like other therapists who want to start projects, I will help them sometimes because I want more people like me on the internet providing science-based, you know, content. And so yeah, maybe content consultants or a music teacher.
I don't know. I could see that.
Yeah. Or I could create another YouTube channel myself, like just sure. like a news channel or something. Yeah. I don't know. Isabel, patron Isabel says, would you rather eat only potatoes or only salad forever? You can make them into whatever fashion you like. What do you think, Berto? Potatoes or salad?
I'd have to go potatoes because at least the potatoes have a little bit of protein.
And but you could put protein in a salad.
Oh, I see. I guess you could go pretty. Okay, fine. Can I cheat and have potatoes in the salad?
Or potato salad?
Yeah.
No, I don't think you can.
I mean, when I interpreted salad, I was thinking a little more like, you know, you got your greens with a little dressing or something. Sure, if I can go a little more well-rounded on the salad, I guess salad it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, right? Because are we talking every manifestation of salad? Because you can have a salad that has a lot of solids in it, you know?
Right. That's like, what I'm thinking, you know.
Like a tuna salad or a salmon salad or
right.
a Greek salad
I think that's cheating.
But I don't know. Like, so it's hard to answer the question.
But I do love potatoes. I love me potatoes.
But if I were to answer kind of honestly, it'd be potatoes because the amount of potato chips and fries and other kinds of
mashed potatoes and other kind of latkes and potato everything.
Yeah, my mouth is watering. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm half made out of potatoes because of that reason. Carla, patron Carla says, what is the first memory that pops into your brain as you read this question? Berto.
Oh my gosh. Running around Green Lake with my friend Ron.
For me, it was, since the word first memory, like one of my very first memories popped in my head, which is trying to running up that hill, and I couldn't make it, and my parents and family, my older siblings, gave me a pep talk, and I managed to get up the hill. Caitlin, patron Caitlin, says, what is the best vacation you've ever taken, and why?
Bernie. Oh, well, I mean, that one's really interesting. So I went for my honeymoon to Disney World, and so that was epic because, you know, it's like your honeymoon, and you're in Disney World. And on top of which, I found out there that I got a job offer while I was on my honeymoon in Disney World.
Was that your idea or her idea?
It was our idea. Huh. It was mutual.
That's a great honeymoon. Usually, it was amazing. People don't think of that as a honeymoon.
Yeah, and it was a whole week. It was in Orlando. We did Disney World and Universal Studios and everything. And it was just grand. It was so awesome. So yeah, that was it.
Okay. For me, it would be Santorini with my wife. Mm. Santorini is a small...
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
Island in the Mediterranean.
I've never been, but your pictures were unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, the view obviously was amazing. I mean, everywhere you look, it was just incredible. But the vibe of the island, there's a few different little towns.
Yeah.
The vibe of me and my wife, we stayed in one of those cliff houses. The memories I have from that trip, it was magical.
That's great.
Patron Emily says, what is your favorite instrument, Berto?
Oh, well, to play in a band, bass. To
Well, you got to pick one instrument, Berto.
Okay,
what's
then
your
voice?
Voice.
Does that count?
No, like aside from voice.
Oh, okay, aside from voice, then piano.
Yeah, for me, guitar. Patron or non-patron, enthusiastic fan of psychology in Seattle, they call themselves. How do we form friendships that are as deep as the one you guys have?
Oh.
Berto?
Well, you have to form it by doing things together that you care about. You have to be patient. You have to let time go by. And
what do you mean?
Have to... Well, you know...
Tell me now.
Some of it you can't fake. Like, you can't just magically have what you have in the first few days that you will develop over 10 years.
Or even, the first year.
Yeah.
There's something I said. Was,
right. But you do need patience, and you need to do things together that you're excited about. And you need to be thoughtful. You know, you do need to think about the other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only things I would add to that are take the good with the bad.
Yeah.
You know, that you get entangled enough with someone, you're going to experience their bad side.
And that's right.
If you run away from everyone whenever, and you know, the bad side could be pretty bad.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, it's up to you case by case, but if every time you run into someone's bad side, you run away because of, you know, you deserve boundaries, as people will say, then you'll never have any close friends in my experience. Yeah. The other thing is to start a podcast together because it forces you to have eye contact and talk.
It does.
Paula from Australia says, favorite hero and favorite villain and why? Berto.
Favorite hero. My favorite hero I've talked about before is Superman. It's cheesy, but it's real. It's because he stands for something. He stands for ultimate, like, we're gonna do good, damn it. We're gonna really try it.
Yeah.
We're gonna do this thing.
Well, he's not, it wouldn't say damn it. He just said,
darn it. Yeah. Gosh, darn
like,
it.
I watched the end of Superman, the first Christopher Reeve movie.
Yeah.
And he gets Lex Luthor in the end, spoiler alert, and he flies him directly into prison.
Into prison.
And, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, it's like, like without a trial. He was, but he flies him directly into prison.
Which is why, but that is where I developed my idea that O.J. Simpson would have gone straight to jail.
Yeah.
Because I watch movies like that.
Yeah, right. And the guard tower, the guard of the guard tower, sees Superman drop off Lex Luthor. And the guard says, "Thank you, Superman. You're our hero. You're the best," or something like that. Uh-huh. And as Superman kind of turns and starts flying away slowly, he turns back. He says, "Nope, we're all in this together."
Yes.
You know?
And yes.
It almost kind of chokes me up.
Yes.
And he pulls it off, you know, like Christopher Reeve. Like and you get this feeling as an audience member that it's just like, yeah, you know, we can all, you know, win over evil.
Combination of ultimate power with ultimate humility. And it's like, yeah, no, I'm just here doing my part.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I love that. And then was the other one villain?
Yeah.
Well, of all time villain, I would say I'd actually go with... I've talked about Sandman series. Sandman is my favorite graphic novel series. And I'd say probably the Lucifer character in that is really great. They're not like a traditional villain, but even though it is Lucifer. But it's just a really interesting, deep character that has its own very biased motivations, and I like it. And then there's this whole spin-off series of graphic novels for Lucifer, and it examines that character in greater detail, and I really like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, I think I watched more than just the ending of that Superman movie, and the Gene Hackman is, and the writing, and the best part of the movie is between Lex Luthor and his assistant, played by, I can't remember, he's the guy who goes squeal like a pig. That guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this woman, Miss Tussmeyer or something. Yeah. The interaction between those three, best cinema. And it really just points to a different time when the writing, you know, because they didn't have the special effects, you know, toys that they do today. And so they just had to sit in a room and talk and actually have good dialogue.
Yep.
And so the lines and the comedy and the exposition that is done and the physicality and the character development, you know, because for most people, including myself, aside from the cartoon, which doesn't go into the characters that much, my conceptualization of Lex Luthor was pretty limited, but seeing that movie in 1981 or whatever, you absolutely know who Lex Luthor is halfway through the movie.
Yeah.
So the and then you think about all the other movies now with villains and the way that they just don't really allow for that kind of dialogue, that kind of just slow dialogue. Anyway, but my favorite hero is Luke Skywalker. Similar reason for Uberto. But plus, like, you know, Luke was introduced to me when I was 6 years old. And
lived the way he throws the lightsaber away like he doesn't care.
And the more and more I think about that movie, the more I hate it. I didn't mind it when it first came out, but after episode 9. And especially with all the themes that they, you know, I've watched all these YouTube videos that break down how horrible the writing is with a lot of the stuff, and the way that they treated our heroes, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, others in these, you know, sequel things. It's like they all got together and said, "We want to always subvert expectation all the time."
Right.
Like, we can never, everyone thinks Luke is going to be the savior of the galaxy. Well, I'm going to make it so he's the opposite. He's like some kind of cantankerous asshole who, you know, just wants to be annoying all the time and drinks blue milk right out of the udder, you know? And so, anyway, but Luke was introduced to me when I was 6 and lived with me until I was 12 years old. And, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
And his goodness and his story arc, you know, in the end, he throws down his weapon and says, "I'm not going to fight you, Father. Yeah. I know that there's good in you." And that's what wins the day.
That's right.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful.
My favorite villain is Alex from A Clockwork Orange.
Oh,
because that character is one of the best characters of all time.
So scary.
patron or listener Boring Girl says to Dr. Kirk, have you ever been to Manzanar, the desert concentration camp used for Japanese immigrants during World War II? I believe it's in California. I visited and it made me feel quite somber and bleak. It must have been extremely harsh on those people. Yeah, I've been to Manzanar. It was worse for my family because my family was in Wyoming, which the weather is much worse, at least from my understanding, than Manzanar. I mean, of course, it's not like the people in Manzanar were, you know, living it up. But imagine a Wyoming winter with just a thin layer of plywood, no insulation between you and they just put these houses together with plywood and nails. Yeah. You know, it was very just thrown together. So,
oh my gosh.
So yeah, I've been to Manzanar and it was quite moving. And I believe that they're making it more of a thing. When I went there, I don't know what it's like now, but it was just there. Like you just walked up to it and walked. There was no workers.
Placard.
Barely.
Yeah.
So you kind of had to know what, like you would drive by it and not know what it was. You know, I think it was pre the point where they started actually renovating these places. And Nanalu says, rollerblades or roller skates? Berto.
Oh, I like roller skates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely roller skates. Rollerblades I've limited experience with, and the couple times I've worn them, I've almost killed myself.
Yeah, I tried them. I don't like the feel as much.
Yeah. Yeah, skates, although can be treacherous, you're much more attached to the ground.
Yeah.
One from Brooklyn, New York says, what's your favorite season? Like, you know, autumn.
Yeah.
What's your favorite season, Berto?
Equator in Colombia, no season. no, in all seriousness, although I love a snowy, like, winter day, you know, I do love that. I'm much more of a sun person, so I would say summer, but really, I kind of miss having... Look, in Colombia, I get so jealous. Like, my friends from Colombia send me a picture or a video or something, because for the weekend... Just for the weekend. It's not even a three-day weekend. Just for the weekend, they drove 2 hours, and they're like in a tropical paradise. It's so easy in Colombia to just go to like amazing weather and amazing vistas and stuff. So I'm like, yeah, I like that. And it's all year round. All year round.
Yeah, I would say summer, maybe fall. But you know, anyone from Seattle knows that the summer is just perfect, unless you have wildfires because of climate change. Listener Layla says, what are you dressing as this coming Halloween? Well, this was asked to us in August. So
what did we dress as?
Berto and I went, if you saw any pictures on social media, as Daniel and Johnny from
Cobra Kai and
from
Miyagi-Do.
Yeah, from the first Karate Kid movie. And Stacy went as... the girlfriend Elizabeth Shue, who her name is Allie.
Allie, yeah.
Anonymous says, favorite... And by the way, when you showed up with that wig, I mean, you looked a lot like Johnny, and it was weird with you with that blonde wig. Yeah. I mean, it really transformed your face.
Halfway through the night, I put some red stuff that looked like blood on my...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Favorite film that you watched for the first time together? So favorite film that you and I watched for the first time together, what would you say?
I mean, the way I felt after watching episode 7,
yeah,
even though it's not, we went through something.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was
my friend, brother too.
A friend movie-gasm. Yeah. Yeah, your brother as well. Like,
we were just oh!
Yeah, I mean, looking back at that movie, it's like, it's really tainted by 9 in particular. But at the time, we hadn't had a new movie since the prequels, which were 15 years prior, 20 years prior. And to see this modern production, and it's a well-put-together movie, the visuals, the pacing is pretty good. There's some issues looking at it now where, like, when Rey picks up Luke's lightsaber and sees all these visions, lot of those things didn't pay off, but it felt like it might in the time. So, and the fact that there, I mean,
and the fact that we knew is that Luke's, that's Luke's lightsaber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought they set up Rey pretty well.
Yeah.
And I thought when they found the Millennium Falcon, like that was,
that moment was cool.
Yeah. And when Han shows up,
that piece of junk.
Yeah. And I feel like prior to that movie coming out, that sort of stunt cameo action wasn't as prevalent. I feel like today, if you saw that, you'd be like, well, of course, Han's going to, you know, I feel like every big production, you just expect it now. At the time, it didn't seem possible that Han Solo would actually show up in this universe, but he did, and it made some sense at least.
Yeah.
And yeah, the pacing, BB-8.
Because you and I had watched a lot of movies together and enjoyed a lot of them. Some of them were great movies. But this was a movie that had all this extra significance.
Yeah.
Because it was Star Wars.
And it was, you know, like I said, I think it's a, I don't know. I think it's a, it was one of the best movie experiences I've ever had. It was, I thought it would suck. I was worried it was going to be bad. And it either was actually legit good, and or it tricked me enough into believing I was watching something good that at the end of watching it, you and I were just like,
oh my God,
we were like giddily giggling and talking. And I mean, it was, we couldn't stop talking about the movie. Yeah. It was so good. Yeah. Cassandra says, do you think you two will interact more with TikTok? I think you should. Well, Berto, you're not on TikTok. The answer is no, because I would love to, but find that I don't need more social media in my life. I don't even know if I will be posting on TikTok in perpetuity. I don't know if it actually... the only reason why I'm posting on TikTok now is that I feel like there's a huge audience on TikTok that needs to see at least some expert that... I'm not saying I'm a genius, but I represent a field of clinicians that know what they're talking about. So that I'm not unique in that way among clinicians. But the amount of bullshittery going on TikTok about psychology is so pronounced and so overwhelming that... I feel like someone needs, and I'm not the only one, of course, there are dozens of others like me, but I feel like I need to do my part to at least provide some evidence-based, well-balanced expert information. So that's literally the only reason, because I don't want more fame. I don't care about
more. I don't want to participate with TikTok because I have these, maybe they're incorrect, but I feel like not a great thing for kids. There's a lot of sort of predatory content on there. And also there's a lot of concerns about it being used as a means for espionage.
Totally.
And like you said, I don't need more social stuff.
Yeah. I have no doubt that the government has some hand in what happened. I mean, the amount of control that the Chinese government has. I mean, like I was talking about earlier, how I will sometimes be hired as a consultant for content.
Right.
This one podcast that's in Chinese, but it's trying to provide psychology and relationship help from a clinician in Chinese, in Mandarin. And they are hiring me to help them to get it off the ground. And one of the things that, you know, I'm learning is that there's a whole list of things they can't even talk about. They can't even mention. They just can't mention at all. And imagine that, you know, imagine me as a podcaster. Right. I can't talk about how American culture is bad in this way or that way. I mean, you know, even staying away from talking about a political party or the government, like there's certain things you can't even criticize by law, or else someone will hear you and at the very least eliminate your podcast from beginning to end, or might even prosecute you, you know?
Yeah.
So do I think that the Chinese government is looking at the treasure trove that is TikTok and just looking the other way. No, that's ridiculous to think. So yeah, I think the government should do something, because I normally wouldn't think this way, but after the meddling in our politics in 2016 that became so clear from Russia, China, I think, is just better at it, or more, right. I don't know, subtle in there. And plus, it's unclear as to what their agenda is. But I wish we weren't antagonists with each other. We don't have to be. We obviously could be fucking working together.
Right.
There's zero threat that China and Russia and the United States have against each other. It's just old school paranoia about ridiculous notions. Like, there's no reason why we can't be on the same page, you know, especially when you think about just being greedy and economy wise, like our economies and our well-beings are intrinsically linked, you know? So you think that at least greed would override their nationalism or something. But anyway, I don't know. Do you think the government should do something about TikTok?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I will say that the few times I have sort of scrolled through TikTok, it can be very addicting. The amount of good, interesting content that the algorithm eventually figures out how to feed you is, there's a lot out there. And it's pretty weird, because you don't make any money off TikTok.
Right.
I think maybe if you have humongous numbers on TikTok, you'll get $100 here and there. It's really quite astonishing to me, because, you know, YouTube, you get a fair amount of money from YouTube if you have content that even has a small audience. And so, you know, people putting quality content on YouTube, you understand, because you could make millions of dollars, PewDiePie, you know, these people. But you wonder, why are people volunteering their... Now, you know, of course, there are people that probably launch other parts of their career, right? They become huge on TikTok, and then they sell some sort of class on the side or something. But a lot of people on TikTok seemingly are just people making interesting videos at no... And they're not trying to sell anything.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
It's probably just trying to get notoriety.
Just volunteering your time and effort. Because some of these videos are pretty elaborate and well-written and showcasing certain comedic talents and stuff. And so it's, you know, it makes me wonder, as I say it out loud, if it's kind of a fad, like in a few years, people will say, why am I doing this? Like, that, this is...
Questioning your choices.
Yeah, like I'm spending 40 hours a week on something that doesn't benefit my life in any practical way. You know what I mean? I don't know.
And then the content dries up.
Yeah. Anonymous says, if we have three more to go, Berto. If you were the Starship Enterprise, if you were on the Starship Enterprise, what would you want your role or job to be? Berto.
Ooh, yeah, I want to be in the science wing for sure, investigating the stuff that's being brought from the planets, you know, and I'm like trying to find new compounds and, like, you know, trying to advance the science.
So when you think Enterprise, what Enterprise do you think of?
Just now I was thinking Next Generation.
Yeah.
But honestly, I'd love to be in the old school, you know, submarine. Mm-hmm.
For me, I would probably end up being a red shirt, just because that's the most numerous. But if I had a choice, I would want to be whatever Commander Troy was, as the quote-unquote counselor. But I would actually try to do counseling things. You know, it's a trope that for her, something obviously they'd be interacting with an alien.
Yeah,
and obviously there's some hostile intent from the alien, and you know, Captain Picard would mute the feed and...
what do you think, Troy?
What do you think? And she would say, I'm sensing a hostility, but I'm not quite sure. And it's like, no, duh. Like, it was always something that was really obvious and never really propelled the story forward. Good old Katie says, what is your favorite non-psychology activity hobby? Berto.
Well, I mean, I love video games. I love playing video games with friends. That's a fun thing I do.
Yeah. I would say same. But if I were to just look at my life, I would say looking at Reddit or clicking endless YouTube videos.
Yeah, same with me on the YouTube videos.
Suggestions, yeah. Last question, Berto. And then we'll be finally done with the 14th.
Oh, my gosh.
Anonymous asks, if you could change any one thing in your house, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, my bathroom, my master bathroom sucks. The worst sucking of all time. It's just the shower. And the shower is too short, like the head. I always have to work on my quads so that the shower's not below me.
That and drives me bonkers.
Yeah, dude. And then it's moldy because it's like this old thing and there's these little ridges and the ridges get moldy.
I don't think I've ever been in that bathroom.
Oh, no, I don't think so. But oh my gosh, I hate it. That's what I would change.
I would change the stairs in my house because they're not carpeted or anything like that, and it feels uncomfortable.
Is it dangerous?
Well, kind of, you know. And falling downstairs can, you know, legit. And I feel like if it had some carpet, it would be less slippery. Because sometimes, like, Stacy will slip because she's wearing socks or something. And
jinx.
Like, I worry one day that you know, someone's going to break their back.
Oh, my gosh.
So I would make the stairs stickier or I don't know. I feel like carpet would help.
Install an elevator.
I thought about that, too. I mean, because we were thinking, I mean, hoping that this would be the last house we buy, right? And we just, because, you know, we like it and we've been renovating a lot.
It's a great house.
And I thought, when we were talking, like, well, you know, when we were really old, the stairs might be impossible for us. And there's actually a perfect spot for an elevator.
Really?
Off that other side of the house.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's just this sheer, you know, full side of one house that's straight up and down.
Yeah.
And you could absolutely put an elevator there. Yeah. You know? And some people, like Lita, the other person
we
started the podcast with 14 years ago, she lives in a house in Albuquerque that has an elevator.
Nice.
And it's just a regular house. It's not like some, you know, weird, I don't know why the elevator, maybe the previous owners.
There was an elevator in my, so when I lived in Queens, in Jackson Heights, when I was five, we lived in the second floor, maybe third floor, of a building that was three or four floors, and there was an elevator in it. And so it's kind of weird, like, elevator opens and it empties into your little tiny two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even a hallway. It wasn't like elevator opens into a hallway with, no, it's just, it opens right into your apartment.
Although, was it a really tiny elevator?
Yeah.
I've recovered from most of my claustrophobia, but I can't do that.
Not like that.
Yeah. Like Lita's elevator, for example, I think we got in it once and I was like, never put me, this is a nightmare to me.
As a kid, though, imagine how cool it was because it's like, I've got an elevator in my apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like another challenge for me along those lines was being in Japan because there's a lot of, you know, space saving that Japan does. And one of the ways that they save space in Tokyo is to have these extremely tiny elevators.
Oh.
And I remember one time, because a lot of the buildings in Tokyo, they'll take this tiny little plot of land and build like a 15-story building, and the square footage is like 700 square feet or something, and each floor is a different business. And so there might be a restaurant on the ninth floor. And so you take this tiny little elevator up to the top, but I'd be like, I'm taking the stairs.
Dude, many, many years ago, I was in the International District at my friend Eric's. You know Eric. He was living there in this apartment. And he was having some party or something. So there's a whole bunch of people there. And he had an elevator in that building. But it was one of these like rickety, weird elevators. And everyone piles in and half of them all of them are drunk. And I have like this feeling, I'm like, I'll take the stairs. And they're all making fun of me. Yeah, chicken. So I walk downstairs and I'm waiting. They got stuck, dude. The fire department had to come.
Oh.
It was a big deal. And they were stuck for a while. So when they all got out, I didn't want to say anything, but man, I was so happy. And I'm like, I told you so.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a party killer that would be.
Oh, yeah, totally. Think about it. Like, especially because they were all making fun of me. And it's like, who's laughing now? Of course, I'm the one who cut the cables, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and when I was in high school, a friend of mine and I, we were working at a banquet at a hotel in Seattle somewhere, and they had this elevator that was glass. And so we had to ride the elevator frequently to get from the kitchen to the banquet, And so him and I, we would, you know, we'd pile in the elevator, and we were, I don't know, we were probably 13 or 14, and we're joking around in the elevator, and we started jumping up and down. And we noticed that when we jumped up and down, it would actually kind of make the elevator start to, I don't know, kind of rock around. And this is an elevator, again, it's on the outside of the building, right? It's not in a shaft.
Yeah.
There's this panoramic, you know, window view.
Oh my gosh.
And so we were okay, well, let's jump at the same time. And so we were purposely trying to jam this elevator.
Oh no.
Because I can't remember what it was doing. It was like bouncing up and down. Like we would bounce and then it would reverberate. It would kind of go wah, wah, wah. And we thought of it as our own personal like roller coaster.
Oh my God.
We did it one too many times and it just stopped. Because I'm guessing
it's got a safety thing
that says something's wrong.
Right.
And it stopped halfway in between
floors.
And we're like, oh shit, we're in so much trouble. And this is before they had cameras in every elevator. Yeah. So that, you know, when they finally got us out, the fire department, we just said, I don't know what happened.
Who knows?
We had a lot of time to make sure that our story was down pat before we got.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but back then I didn't have claustrophobia, so it didn't really matter to me. Maybe that's where it developed. I don't know.
Ooh.
All right, Berto, we have a lot more emails that we'll get to maybe another time, but we finally finished. So we're officially done with the 14th anniversary.
Just in time to start planning for the 15th.
Exactly. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.